For the recording then, my name is Paul Olson, and this is a session with poetry and war and peace and patriotism and love as rendered by some different poets, and I'm calling poets now some writers of fiction as well. And if we get that far, and the fiction writer I'm going to use is J.D. Salinger, and with some explanation on that. When I was in grad school, I learned that to like J.D. Salinger wasn't cool. I mean, that wasn't academic enough. I mean, anybody that's written, you know, a book that's popular for little kids and has changed their lives, like yours might, it can't be good literature, I guess. So they said, "You like Salinger?" I said, "Yeah, I think his short story, For Esme with Love and Squalor, might be one of the greatest American short stories ever written." And it's turning out that a lot of people are thinking that. So we might look at some parts of that. It's Salinger's anti-war story.
Say the title again.
For Esme with Love and Squalor. And I'll get to that. I think we will. We'll just see how we do with our own discussion as well. I once memorized a poem. The title of it was "Silence" by Edgar Lee Masters, or by Archibald MacLeish. And it goes like this, and I've got it written just in case I screw up my memory here. We are voiceless in the presence of realities. We cannot speak. A curious boy asked an old soldier sitting in front of the grocery store, "How did you lose your leg?" The old man is struck by silence. His mind flies away and he cannot concentrate it on Gettysburg. It returns jocosely and he says, "A bear bit it off." And his mind flies away to the flashes of guns, the thunder of cannon, the shrieks of the slain, himself lying on the ground, the hospital surgeons, the knives, the long days in bed. But if he could describe it all, he would be an artist. But if he were an artist, there would be deeper wounds which he could not describe. That's my introduction to poetry and war. What do you make of that? Especially the last four lines. We've got the images of knives and surgeons and the shrieks of the slain and so on. But then this, if he were an artist, he could describe it. But then if he were an artist, there would be still deeper wounds. Any thoughts about that?
Deeper wounds that it doesn't, does it end there?
That he could not describe.
Okay.
Yeah, good, thank you.
That's why I wrote it up.
If you're an artist, you could describe it. I mean, artists have the words. And poets work to find the words, and they craft, and they create, and create, and they recreate, and they recraft, and they. But they finally get the words that this is it. So this poet is saying the artist could do that, but then there's a deeper level that he still couldn't describe. We'll move on to this, but
What I was going to say is, it seems to me one of the things that's interesting about those lines is that frequently we find, I think, that an artist can describe something more deeply or differently than we ourselves describe it,
right,
in ordinary, quote, ordinary experience. But what the poet is saying is that the artist, there are levels that the artist doesn't touch either. I mean,
his own levels or her own levels. I think it's not so much about what an artist can't do. Is about how deep the artist thinks and feels about this in a level that's past our own kind of cursory view of war.
Was it comparing it with a leg?
He starts out saying, well, he has these images of war.
Right.
This guy remembers those, this
right.
old man. And he's not an artist.
Right.
And the poet says, if he were an artist, he could describe it all. Because poets are better than we are.
Right.
You're a poet, so you're up there with those guys. And so poets can describe in ways, because of their sensitivity, their use of language, and their craft with language, they can do this. But the poet himself is arguing, but if he were an artist, there would be, because of an ultra kind of sensitivity, there would be deeper wounds, which he could still not, it still isn't in our head, or he couldn't describe. Well, what we want to use that for is we're going to look at some poems and maybe some fiction and just see how these artists create a different complexity about war for us. And the first comparison to bring up, and then we'll move right past it, is that the least poetic thing we heard after 9/11 came from the mouth of the President of the United States. Does anybody remember what he said?
We'll get him or something.
Yeah, it's some moment of revenge. And I think as an English teacher, what I try to do more than anything else, that literature is kind of a vehicle to help students think in a different way. I never thought of that process. To give you a simple example, it has nothing to do with African American literature, which is my special field, and I teach two different courses in that. I hand out a sheet of paper that has how many liters of water it takes to make a kilo, to create a kilo of beef, rice, corn, potatoes, and so on. What does it have to do with anything? I'll give you my point in a second. So they find out it takes 42,000 liters of water to create a kilo, 2 pounds. Of beef. It takes 200 liters of water to create a kilo of potatoes. So what does that say, you know, the Tolstoy's question, how then do I live? Maybe we should stop and everybody's with me on that? The resources used to create our McDonald's hamburger are considerable. That's thinking with that knowledge about something in a completely different way. I always thought I picked my hamburger, I picked my food because of what tasted best. And now I'm going to have to use something else. I'm going to have a whole different thinking process. Does that make sense? Brought into us. Okay, that's the goal of, I think that's what poetry can do for us, is that, and that's what this poet is saying too. We're going to go a step further than we've gone before. One critic, his name is Kenneth Burke, has a line that I like. Literary works can serve as equipment for living, is his quote. And then Tolstoy has in the book itself says, how, do I live? Once I have this experience, a poet, or this knowledge from the poetry, how then do I live? So we're going to look at the complexity of war as it's, and we'll, let's let you comment as you hear this, because the poems speak for themselves, and we don't need me to do it. And I, once again, I need my glasses, sorry. So we're going to just try to go to a level that... Okay. The Spoon River Anthology is simply, this is an oversimplification. Edgar Lee Masters just walked through a graveyard and saw the names on, and this is in his imagination, saw the name on a gravestone and created a poem from what he knew about that person's death. Here's the one to Dick Sapper. The ordinance of Spoon River permitted the preaching of Jesus on the streets by salvationists and fundamentalists. So I went to the square one day with the Bible and began to read, "Woe unto you lawyers who build the sepulchres of the prophets." And being known as a socialist, they put me in jail for talking socialism on the public square. Well, the war came on. This is the dead man, right? He's imagining this dead man speaking to us now. Well, the war came on, and Ezra Fink had written a letter to Spoon River to buy war bonds until we were broke. And I opposed it, and even opposed a lawless and hellish draft in the name of Jesus of Nazareth, as I thought. So they put me in prison for 20 years, where my body broke and my spirit broke, and where in vain I tried to be pardoned. And I coughed and cursed to that awful moment when the blood of my body shot from my mouth like a gushing hose, and I was dead. And some of you call this a republic. Well, some of you be damned, and God damned. Any responses? Just like Reverend Wright. Oh, wow, I hadn't thought of that. But you're right, in the context of what he talks about, if we've heard his whole sermon, I have, it's a different thing. But what about patriotism and the war and everybody? There it is, right? Buy bonds until you're broke. Help the war effort. It's the World War II, or World War I in this case, the World War I response to support the troops that are on the stickers in the back of the SUVs and trucks and cars.
Well, it doesn't sound like you really have freedom of speech. I mean, you can't speak against what government or what, you know, is saying.
I coughed and I cursed to that awful moment with the blood of my body. And he is viscerally, physically ruined. Shot from my mouth, a concussion hose, and I was dead. Well, here's one, four lines to the unknown soldiers. This is the only two I'm going to read of his. Stranger, looking up. I mean, the dead man, right? Tell the people of Spoon River two things. First, that we lie here obeying their words. And next, that had we known what was back of their words, we would not be lying here. Where was it?
Or Vietnam, or...
Yeah, of course. Exactly. And good poetry will speak not only to its own period. African Americans have, I'm generalizing, a different war, or have had a different war, still do as we pay any attention at all to the current political situation. And in the 60s, a group of poets called the Revolutionary Poets spoke out loud and clear and created what I think people would then have called stage poems. They're meant to be heard rather than in front of the page. They're on the page too, and that's where I've got it, of course. But rather than just on the page where you have to read and think and reflect, and these were just meant to be heard and to be more of a visceral level kind of poetry. And this is the Ballad of Birmingham, you probably do, but when that might need to be reminded of what happened in Birmingham in 1956, four little girls. You know that story?
63.
That might be right.
63,
in the church.
In the church, yeah. Okay, well, here's the poem.
Yeah.
Mother dear, may I go downtown instead of out to play? And march the streets of Birmingham in a freedom march today. No, baby, no, you may not go, for the dogs are fierce and wild, and clubs and hoses, guns and jails ain't good for a little child. There's a memorial park right across the street from that church now, and if you ever go there, you will just feel that you're standing on hallowed ground. I mean, the outside stairway that goes to the basement has been sealed off and covered over, but you can still see where the bricks cover the top part of the door. And across the street is this park, and they've made metal statues of just one-dimensional flat. And there are cops, and you see guys holding hoses and shields. And that is a memorializing an idea for this poem. The dogs are fierce and wild, and you see these metal dogs jumping out from these guys holding the hoses. So one more time, no, baby, no, you may not go, for the dogs are fierce and wild. And clubs and hoses, guns and jails ain't good for a little child. But mother, I won't be alone. Other children will go with me and march the streets of Birmingham to make our country free. No, baby, no, you may not go, for I fear those guns will fire. But you may go to church instead and sing in the children's choir. She has combed and brushed her night dark hair and bathed rose petals sweet and drawn white gloves on her small brown hands and white shoes on her feet. The mother smiled to know her child was in the sacred place, but that smile was the last smile to come upon her face. For when she heard the explosion, her eyes grew wet and wild. She raced through the streets of Birmingham, calling for her child. She clawed through bits of glass and brick, then lifted out a shoe. Oh, here's the shoe my baby wore, but baby, where are you? We're not asking to make that be great poetry, but what happens with it? To the listener, this is the stage poem. And you can be specific in your response, or you can be general about what are we hearing about war and about time to fight and the time not to fight and whatever it comes to your mind.
You know, I don't understand people that aren't affected by something like that.
Or not affected.
By the poem or by the,
yeah.
The murder?
That aren't affected, you know, that would... That they would be sensitized to what they
to do that, even, you mean? Yeah. That's a great point, and that's going to lead us to where they are not, somebody's not sensitized apparently, or hates so much that they can do this to just innocent. I mean, they know what's down there. It's a kid's Sunday school. Mm-hmm. Well, here's the one on a completely different note, and I've heard him read this. His name is Don L. Lee. He's changed it, but. Do you remember, well, I'll ask you the question afterwards. I'll ask us afterwards. This is how Donnell Lee reads this poem. The Paris Peace Talks, 1968. What happened in the Paris Peace Talks in 1968? Who remembers?
They argued about the shape of the table.
They argued about the shape of the table. And they argued for 6 months. And the toll, I mean, the death toll rose in those 6 months. So what do you do with a poem like that on stage? There isn't a poet alive. I could probably say it differently. There isn't a poet dead. When you look at the old definitions of poetry given by the Coleridges and the Wordsworths and the Samuel Johnsons, you see, this is what creates a great poem. They have a different paradigm that they see, you know, a poem through. Is that a poem? And that's not our job today, but, well, maybe it is. Is that a poem? Two roads diverged in the yellow wood, and sorry I cannot travel both and be one. That's a poem, everybody knows, right? But just give words for that. Whatever comes to your head.
Well, it's like, see, I look at all the different arts, and for me it's like music. There's melodic music, and there's music that is just sound. But it's sound that's orchestrated. And to me, that's like a piece of percussion. And that's still
music. That's good.
Yeah, I was thinking jazz in particular in that way. I happen to like melodic jazz more than non-melodic jazz, but I recognize jazz can be non-melodic.
Yeah. So this is unpoetic or unmelodic.
Same with painting, with visual art.
But the crown, it sounded more like a machine that was going bad.
Listen to that. Yeah. A machine that's going bad.
Right.
6 months they're in there with their machine and it's gone bad. That's exactly the kind of response I think that Donnell Lee is looking for. Is that the first time I ever heard him read it, I said, my response, you know, the classical kind of education and what poetry is about, that's absurd. Yeah. Point. This is absurd. Okay, well, you got it. And that's a poet going somewhere differently than we might have gone. And here's something still different. And I grew up in Minnesota. The son of full-blooded Norwegians, and other than having an Indian reservation, a Native American reservation right close by, and those kids came into town for the high school, I didn't have a clue about racial justice or anything. I just, you know, went and picked up my basketball and played, and then when that was over, I picked up the next season, whatever it was. It was in grad school. And the first African-American, then called black, the first black poem I ever heard was read to me in a seminar class taught by a radical black poet, Elvin Hobart. And so here I am, Luther College graduate, Minnesota raised, and this is the poem he read. Nigger, can you kill? Can you kill? Can a nigger kill? Can a nigger kill a honky? Can a nigger kill a man? Can you kill nigger? Huh? Can you kill? Do you know how to draw blood? Can you poison? Can you stab a Jew? Can you kill? Huh? Nigger, can you kill? Can you run down a Protestant with your S68 Eldorado? That's all they're good for anyway. Can you kill? Can you piss on a blonde head? Can you cut it off? Can you kill? A nigger can die. We ain't got to prove we can die. We got to prove we can kill. They sent us to kill Japan and Africa. We policed Europe. Can you kill? Can you kill a white man? Can you kill the nigger in you? Can you make your nigger mind die? Can you kill your nigger mind and free your black hands to strangle? Can you kill? Can a nigger kill? Can you shoot straight and fire for good measure? Can you splatter their brains in the street? Can you kill them? Can you lure them to bed to kill them? We kill in Vietnam for them. We kill for UN and NATO and CETO and US and everywhere for all alphabet. But black, B-L-A-C-K, can we learn to kill white for black, learn to kill niggers, learn to be black men? That was my response. But that poem changed my life. I mean, my studies went from 19th century British poetry to African-American poetry in one day.
See, now, that kind of poetry arouses the masses of whites, I think. And that's what Wright did, too.
Yeah.
And I don't know how what appropriateness there is there, but I suppose whites think of, why are they so angry, you know? And I remember when Jim Cohn was here many years ago, and I still remember this. I get emotional too.
Sure.
But this one guy says, "Why do you guys hate us so much?" A white guy said, and he says, "Some of my best friends are blacks."
Yeah.
And did he light it? You
know, yeah. Well, we have that's the most common phrase heard, that you're not prejudiced because you have a black friend. And what these poems are about, and
he pointed out that you think he's a friend.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and they, sure. And they can be friends too, but there's attitudinal racism, and there's individual relationships, and then there's systematic, institutionalized racism. That's a different story. You know, you can be best friends with somebody and still help perpetuate the status quo that keeps people oppressed. But there's more here too, and that, those are great comments. Can you kill the nigger in you? Can you make your nigger mind die? That's thinking outside the box. That's asking somebody, that's not just about whites. That's Nikki Giovanni, the poet number two up there, in her voice asking. You can be a solid, the language would have been in the 60s, a black man, or you can be a nigger. Mm-hmm. And a nigger is, what was the language then? The Uncle Tom, coming out of Uncle Tom's Children, the one that's good. Yes, massa, no massa.
I think it was Hertzfeldt was here, and he was saying that a nigger is anybody that lets somebody else identify you.
Yeah. That's a great definition, and there was a book in the early 70s called The Student as Nigger. It had nothing to do with race. The word was, you know, transposed into be, how is a student, just, yes, professor, what do I write, and so on. But to kill the nigger mind, and we got a little asterisk here, and this is a story I'm sure you've heard, but it's, I love it. It says something to me theologically and educationally both. And I heard it first in South Africa from Desmond Tutu. That's my name dropping. And he told this story. It's a joke of this man is walking along the edge of a cliff, and it's just a spectacular, beautiful day. And down, you know, 500 feet straight down is this pristine valley with a river flowing through it. And off to his right are mountains, and they're snow-capped. And it's just a beautiful, pristine sight. And he's so caught up in this that he falls off the cliff. And he falls straight down 500 feet, but halfway down, there's a branch sticking out, and he grabs it. Have you heard this? He grabs the branch, and there he is, 300 feet up, 200 feet down. He's in a pickle. So he cries out, "Help, help, can anybody help me?" And the voice rumbles from the sky, and it's God. "Yes, I can help you. Who are you?" "I am God." "Are you sure you can help me?" "Yes." "What do I have to do?" "Let go." "Is there anybody else up there?" And the story is, he could, in that story, he could come to God, but he can't let go of the most secure thing in his life. So in this poem, that's the nigger mind. Whether it's, like you said, the student is nigger, it's white, it's black, it's anybody that somebody tramples all over. But it's the black man who won't go, in the 60s, who won't go in the streets, who won't march to Montgomery, who won't get on the sit-ins and go through. So here it is again. Can you kill the nigger in you? Can you kill your nigger mind and free your black hands to strangle? I think we'll move on. But we gotta write this word up here. This is war. And There is war that kills people, and then there is war that's metaphorical. And I think some poets take us both places. This is, I mean, we're going to see about war, and it all ties together, I think, in things that are causes about which we're willing to die or to fight for. Okay, here's one. This is classical stuff now. This is what William Butler Yeats, this is the stuff that graduate students study. And we said, this is poetry. Here's one verse of a very famous poem called The Second Coming. And I'll just read the first verse. It's only seven lines long. Turning and turning in the widening, he pronounces it in his poetic gyre, but you know what gyroscope? Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. And there's more to the poem than that. But this is written in 1921. This is World War I. This is also 4 years before the Scopes trial. 1925, the monkey trials, we know. This is 50 years or so after Darwin comes out, and then 30 years after, or before, after, when 50 years before this, Darwin comes out with The Origin of Species. Then he comes out with The Descent of Man, about the same time as a geologist named Charles Lyell, who's kind of saying, you know what, the Earth is 6 billion years old. And all these people who have been literalists in the Bible and creationists, we call them now, are, whoa, taken back. And so put that in, because this is about war, and it's also about a bigger, an even bigger context. One more time now. The whole world is, you mean it's not 6,000 years old? You mean it's not, we can't have these, what's the phrase? These absolutes that are, here again, turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. What's the image? You know, the falconer's got the big leather sleeve. And what image do you, I mean, you've got the image, what do you make of it? The falcon cannot hear the falcon.
So far, it can't return.
It's great. It's beautiful. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. And this is written in 1921, this is the first poem I got out after 2001. And our response to that, turning and turning in the waiting, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center can't hold. So we. The poets are saying, create a center. Create something absolute, something certain. And the certain thing was a way of thinking that said, what? What's the first reaction? Revenge, we're going to get them, we're going to hunt them down. Mere anarchy, oh my gosh, is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Here's Henry Reed. Anybody else? Anything? You'll get it. Today we have the naming of parts. The speaker is an officer in the army, they're talking about cleaning their guns. Today we have the naming of parts. Yesterday we had daily cleaning, and tomorrow morning we shall have what to do after firing. But today we have the naming of parts. Japonica glistens like coral in all of the neighboring gardens. And today we have the naming of parts. This is the lower sling swivel, and this is the upper sling swivel, whose use you will see when you are given your slings. And this is the piling swivel, which in your case you have not got. The branches hold in the gardens their silent, eloquent gestures, which in our case we have not got. This is the safety catch, which is always released with an easy flick of the thumb. And please do not let me see anyone using his finger. You can do it quite easy if you have any strength in your thumb. The blossoms are fragile and motionless, never letting anyone see any of them using their finger. And this, you can see, is the bolt. The purpose of this is to open the breech, as you see. We can slide it rapidly backwards and forwards. We call this easing the spring. And rapidly backwards and forwards, the early bees are assaulting and fumbling the flowers. They call it easing the spring. They call it easing the spring. It is perfectly easy if you have any strength in your thumb, like the bolt and the breech and the cocking piece and the point of balance, which in our case we have not got. and the almond blossom silent in all of the gardens, and the bees going backwards and forwards, for today we have naming of parts. Any thoughts? This matters. It was written in 1947. With your guts, just what we have these images that are.
Well, contrast the mechanisms and nature.
Yeah. Good. Mechanisms and nature. And mechanisms, are, all of them are, what are they for? This is the machine that will kill. And you learn to handle it, so learn all its parts. Flick with your, you know, flick it easy with your thumb, don't use your finger. You've got all the instructions on how to do this. And yet, it's counterposed, sure, to nature. Okay.
It makes me think of my days in the Navy on board of the carrier. Yeah. A good friend of mine who turned out to be a Methodist pastor. We used to talk on the catwalk right by the gun tubs. And we had 5-inch twin gun guns.
Yeah.
And we were questioning, why were they here?
Hmm.
Why were we here?
And this is when, what war and when?
Korean
War.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't it part of military training to just, you know, shave off all the possibility of looking outside the channel that they want you to see? So that's so automatic, so automatic.
People wouldn't kill unless they're brainwashed.
Yeah.
I have a son who was a Navy SEAL. You know, the most glorious warriors there are. I am absolutely positive he did that because he just looked and said, what's the hardest job in the world? It surely wasn't out of patriotism. And this is hard, so I'm going to do it. Mm-hmm. But one of the things they do in their later, well, throughout the whole training, is they move from one kind of skill to another every month. And they'll be swimming underwater for, you know, for a month. Not in one shot. They'll be jumping out of planes for a month. They'll be, and one of their month training is sharpshooting, and then when they start the rotation over again, they just get better and better at all these things. And one of the things is called almost a man-to-man combat, but it's target identification, and that's the stuff you've seen in the movies. They kick open the door and they got the gun and they swing it around, and they have to be able to identify a target just like that. And in about his third round, I asked him, I don't know if I can even get through this. I asked him, how's the target identification stuff going? And he didn't say anything for a little bit, and then he said, just like I am, raising his eyebrows, if I see a kick open a door and see a 10-year-old kid with a gun, I'm going to kill him. And I realized then, no wonder these kids come home and have traumatic stress syndrome. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what the poets awaken in us. And now you'll hear one of the really great short stories. This is fiction, and it's Salinger's anti-war story about what one young character calls, a little girl, a method of existence that is absurd to say the least, or that is ridiculous to say the least. And the method of existence is war. But it seems like the conventional thinking never goes past the conventional thinking. Now, that's redundant, I understand that. You had your hand up, and I'll come back to you before. I'm sorry he talked, and you did, but...
I just want to hear Salinger. The conventional thinking in my little hometown every Memorial Day was to gather the whole town in the cemetery below the statue of Colonel Colville and have a complete Memorial Day service. And two things were always read. One was Gettysburg Address. And one was Flanders Field, the poem.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think of how that shaped me and how that didn't shape me.
Yeah. 21 Gun Salute, did they have that too?
Yes.
Yeah.
And taps,
yeah.
And a kind of a warlike speech by some local military person.
Yeah.
But it there's something in me out of that which is patriotic. It's a solemn sort of something, and it's a sorrowful sort of something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm not sure what it isn't. And what these poems convey, I was trying to picture them in place of Flanders Field. Some of these.
Yeah, poems. Yeah.
What would that do to the gathering of townspeople on that day? I'm not sure what I'm asking.
You're explaining. Boy, you just relived my childhood too, going out there, our band. Yeah, yeah.
Thank you for sharing that. How do you tell the difference between glorification of war and honoring the dead? You know, it's really.
Especially now, there's such a political correctness about how we, even if we disagree with the war and the military, it's very important that we respect those who are in it or who have lost loved ones.
Well, it's like the signs, I don't know if you have any around your time, support our troops bring them home.
Mm-hmm.
We need to make that distinction.
But just support our troops means
support our president.
Right, but if you support our troops bring them home, then we've got to.
Yeah.
I guess if patriotism means honoring the dead, I can do it.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that.
Sort of a sad definition, isn't it? It's sort of a sad definition in a sense, right?
Yeah.
I guess
from what I've learned in my small town upbringing, that's what it is. And that's what it always has been. And
that kind of thinking it plays on our the paradigm with which we look at war, through which we look at war, it's honor, it's glory, and it doesn't shape our. I'm just talking, maybe not you individually, not me individually, surely, but not even my son, who was kind of the warrior. And this was one of his friends said, "Dave, you better take 3 years to unseal when he got out." To unseal means to. That's a metaphor for all of us. It could be. Mm-hmm. I mean, to think in a different way.
One of the
guys that ran to Canada, whatever.
One of the things that feels to me quite agonizing about the current situation is, as much as one can say that war is awful, war about which there are huge public doubts seems so much more awful. I mean, we have a man in our church who's career Air Force and had grave doubts about this war from the start. In fact, participated in a little peace vigil, which he never had done before the war started. And his grandson is in the war, And I think of the agony of that, where you don't even have the solace of feeling this was necessary. Even if I think war is bad, this was a necessary one. And what that must be like for parents of kids who are over there, and for kids who are over there who are, are trying to do good things. A lot of them trying to do good things. And I don't know, it'd be interesting to hear a poem about that, because that somehow is even more.
They exist.
I guess they do.
But I don't know if they're poems.
I see.
They're written by politicians. I'm getting my bias across.
How a firing squad, a good friend of mine is a honor guard, and whenever a veteran has a funeral, there's a funeral for him, they go out and fire their guns,
You call that the firing squad?
Well, no. It's
when they put their guns in.
It's the honor guard.
But anyway.
Yeah.
Well, how does that relate to the incident of death? Except if you're at the end of the bus, I don't quite understand. I told him, and he was amazed. I said, at my funeral, I don't want them. So.
I don't think my son went there. This wonderful story, the narrator has just been shipped to England. And he's about to go on the D-Day, the invasion, tomorrow. And he just leaves the camp and walks through London. And he stops in because he hears this choir singing. And he sees a little girl. She just somehow stands out in this choir. And then he moves on. He goes, sits in a cafe, and he meets her. And she comes in with her little brother. And in a couple of really wonderful scenes, she tells him in a subordinate clause, my father was killed in the war, and my mother died. And after we were evacuated, there's a subordinate clause, then we... So all the stuff, and her nails are bitten down to the quick, but she's very, very smart. She's only 11, and she becomes friends, as much as you can, become friends with a guy in a cafe in an hour-long talk. And before he leaves, she says to him, and she's years beyond her years because of what she's experienced. I mean, this woman, this little girl has lost her innocence, that's for sure. And she asks him, because she finds out that he's a writer, "You're quite sure you won't forget to write that story for me?" Because she had asked him to do that. "It doesn't have to be exclusively for me. It can't." I said there was absolutely no chance I'd forget. I told her that I'd never written the story for anybody, but that it seemed like exactly the right thing to get down to. "Make it extremely squalid and moving," she suggested. "Are you at all acquainted with squalor?" I said not exactly, but that I was getting better acquainted with it in one form or another, and that I'd do my best to come up to her specifications. We shook hands. "Isn't it a pity," she said, "that we didn't meet under less extenuating circumstances?" I said it was. I said it certainly was. "Goodbye," Esme said. "I hope you're returned from the war with all your faculties intact." She understands something that isn't, that's way past how we look at war, but she gets it. This, then, is the story he writes. This is the squalid or moving part of the story, and the scene changes, the people too. I'm still around, but from here on in, for reasons I'm not at liberty to disclose, I disguise myself so cunningly that even the cleverest reader will fail to recognize me. Well, in the story, you clearly recognize him, and you clearly know he wants to tell his story, because this guy is insane, and he's aware of it. It's one thing to be insane and not know it. It was about 10:30 at night in Gofert, Bavaria, several weeks after VE Day. Staff Sergeant X was in his room on the second floor. And this, now, the writer is telling the story about himself. And when he says his room, he's talking about me. Staff Sergeant X was in his room on the second floor of the civilian home in which he and 9 other American soldiers had been quartered, even before the armistice. He was seated on a folding wooden chair at a small, messy-looking writing table with a paperback overseas novel open before him, which he was having great trouble reading. The trouble lay with him, not the novel. He took a cigarette from a pack on the table and lit it with fingers that bumped gently and incessantly against one another. He sat back a trifle in his chair and smoked without any sense of taste. He had been chain smoking for weeks. His gums bled at the slightest pressure of the tip of his tongue, and he seldom stopped experimenting. It was a little game he played, sometimes by the hour. He sat for a moment, smoking and experimenting. Now, we don't even know what that means. Then abruptly, familiarly, and as usual, with no warning, he thought he felt his mind dislodge itself and teeter like insecure luggage on an overhead rack. He quickly did what he had been doing for weeks to set things right. He pressed his hands hard against his temples. He held on tight for a moment. His hair needed cutting, and it was dirty. He had washed it 3 or 4 times during his 2-week stay at the hospital in Frankfurt on the Main, but it had got dirty again on a long, dusty jeep ride back to Gofert. Corporal Z, who had called for him at the hospital, still drove a jeep combat style with the windshield down on the hood, armistice or no armistice. After the war was over, they put the windshields up, of course. There were thousands of new troops in Germany. By driving with his windshield down combat style, Corporal Z hoped to show that he was not one of them, that not by a long shot was he some new son of a bitch in the European theater. When he let go of his head, X began to stare at the surface of the writing table, which was a catch-all for at least 2 dozen unopened letters and at least 5 or 6 unopened packages, all addressed to him. He reached behind the debris and picked out a book that stood against the wall. It was a book by Goebbels entitled Die Zeit ohne Beispiel, that means a time without precedent. It belonged to the 38-year-old unmarried daughter of the family that, up to a few weeks earlier, had been living in this house. She had been a low official in the Nazi party, but high enough by army regulation standards to fall into an automatic arrest category. X himself had arrested her. That's, again, him, me. And now, for the third time since he had returned from the hospital that day, he opened the woman's book and read the brief inscription on the flyleaf, written in ink in German in a small, hopelessly sincere handwriting with the words, "Dear God, life is hell." Nothing led up to or away from it. Alone on the page, and in the sickly stillness of the room, the words appeared to have the stature of an uncontestable, even classic, indictment. X stared at the page for several minutes, trying against heavy odds not to be taken in. Then, with far more zeal than anything he had done in weeks, he picked up a pencil stub and wrote down under the inscription in English, "Fathers and teachers, I ponder, what is hell? I maintain that it is the suffering of being unable to love." He started then to write Dostoevsky's name under the inscription, that's a quote from the Brothers Karamazov, but saw with fright that ran through his whole body that what he had written was entirely illegible. He shut the book. He quickly picked up something else from the table, a letter from his older brother in Albany. It had been on his table even before he had checked into the hospital. He opened the envelope, loosely resolved to read the letter straight through, but read only the top half of the first page. He stopped after the words, "Now that the goddamn war is over and you probably have a lot of time over there, how about sending the kids a couple of bayonets or swastikas?" After he had torn it up, he looked down at the pieces as they lay in the wastebasket. He saw that he had overlooked an enclosed snapshot. He could make out somebody's feet standing on a lawn somewhere. The language of the writer that has glorified send the swastikas and the bayonets has caused him to even miss the one thing that maybe could have healed him, began to heal him, that a picture of my family. But he tore it up before. He put his arms on the table and rested his head on them. He ached from head to foot, all zones of pain seemingly interdependent. He was rather like a Christmas tree whose lights, wired in a series, must all go out if even one bulb is defective. The door banged open. Without having been rapped on, X raised his head, turned it, and saw Corporal Z standing on the door. This was the guy that drove the Jeep, right? That was his book. Corporal Z had been X's Jeep partner and constant companion from D-Day straight through the five campaigns of the war. He lived on the first floor, and he usually came up to see X when he had a few rumors or gripes to unload. He was a huge, photogenic young man of 24. During the war, a national magazine had photographed him in Hürtgen Forest. He had posed, more than just obligingly, with a Thanksgiving turkey in each hand. "You writing letters?" he asked X. "It's spooky in here, for Christ's sake." He preferred always to enter a room that had the overhead light on. X turned around in his chair and asked him to come in and to be careful not to step on the dog. "The what?" "Alvin. He's right under your feet, Clay." "No, there is no dog." "Alvin, he's right under your feet, Clay. How about turning off the goddamn light?" Clay found the overhead light switch, flicked it on, then stepped across the puny servant-sized room and sat down on the edge of the bed facing his host. His brick-red hair, just combed, was dripping with the amount of water he remembered. His is dirty and he hasn't washed it for 2 weeks. Was dripping with the amount of water he required for satisfactory grooming. A comb with a fountain pen clip protruded familiarly from the right-hand pocket of his olive drab shirt, and over the left-hand pocket he was wearing the combat infantryman's badge, which technically he wasn't authorized to wear, the European theater ribbon with five bronze battle stars in it, instead of a lone silver one, which was the equivalent of five bronze ones. Every time I read that, I think of when I was a Cub Scout. You got those little silver triangles, you know? And when you had five silver ones, you could replace it with one gold. I never did it. Because I liked five of those babies were on there, and that was stuff.
It was more humble to have one.
Yeah, right. You want all of them. And he also wore the pre-Pearl Harbor service ribbon. He sighed heavily and said, "Christ almighty." It meant nothing. It was Army. He took a pack of cigarettes from his shirt pocket, tapped one out, then put away the pack and rebuttoned the pocket flap. What Selmer's pointing out, and it's beautiful writing, is that this guy can handle his buttons. And the other guy couldn't even smoke. Mm-hmm. I mean, he bumped his finger, he couldn't get the cigarette lit, and you're going to watch it even get worse. But this guy, he taps it, puts away, rebuttons the pocket flap. Smoking, he looked vacuously around the room. His look finally settled on the radio. "Hey, They got this terrific show coming on the radio in a couple of minutes. Bob Hope and everybody. X, opening a fresh pack of cigarettes, said he had just turned the radio off. Undarkened, Clay watched X trying to get a cigarette lit. Jesus, he said with spectator's enthusiasm. You ought to see your goddamn hands. Boy, you got the shakes, you know that? X got his cigarette lit, nodded, and said Clay had a real eye for detail. No kidding, hey, I goddamn near fainted when I saw you at the hospital. You look like a you look like a goddamn corpse. How much weight you lose? How many pounds, you know? I don't know. How was your mail when I was gone? You heard from Loretta? Loretta was Clay's girl. They intended to get married at their earliest convenience. She wrote to him fairly regularly from a paradise of triple explanation points and inaccurate observations. All through the war, Clay had read all Loretta's letters aloud to X, however intimate they were. In fact, the more intimate, the better. It was his custom, after each reading, to ask X to plot out or pad out the letter of reply, or to insert a few impressive words in French or German. Yeah, I had a letter from her yesterday, down in my room. Show it to you later, Clay said listlessly. He sat up straight on the edge of the bed, held his breath, and issued a long, resonant belch. Looking just semi-pleased with the achievement, he relaxed again. Her goddamn brother's getting out of the Navy on account of his hip. He's got this hip, the bastard. He sat up again and tried for another belch, but with below-par results. A jot of alertness came into his face. Hey, before I forget, we got to get up at 5 tomorrow and drive to Hamburg or someplace, pick up Eisenhower jackets for the whole detachment. X, regarding him hostilely, said that he didn't want an Eisenhower jacket. Clay looked surprised, even hurt. Oh, they're good. They look good. How come? No reason. Why do we have to get up at 5? The war's over, for God's sake. I don't know. We got to get back for lunch. They got some new forms and we got to fill out before lunch. I asked Bulling how come we couldn't fill them out tonight. He's got the goddamn forms right on his desk. He don't want to open the envelopes yet, the son of a bitch. The two sat quiet for a moment, hating Bulling. Clay suddenly looked at X with high, newer interest than before. Hey, did you know the goddamn side of your face is jumping all over the place? X said he knew all about it and covered his tick with his hand. Clay stared at him a moment and then said rather vividly, as if he were the bearer of exceptionally good news, I wrote Loretta you had a nervous breakdown. Oh? Yeah, she's interested as hell in all that stuff. She's majoring in psychology. Clay stretched himself out on the bed, shoes included. You know what she said? She says nobody gets a nervous breakdown just from the war and all. She says you probably were unstable like your whole goddamn life. X bridged his hands over his eyes. The light over the bed seemed to be blinding him. And he said that Loretta's insight into things was always a joy. Clay glanced over at him. Listen, you bastard. She knows a goddamn sight more psychology than you do. Do you think you can bring yourself to take your stinking feet off my bed? X asked. Clay left his feet where they were for a few don't tell me where to put my feet seconds, then swung them around to the floor and sat up. I'm going downstairs anyway. They got the radio on in Walker's room. He didn't get up from the bed, though. Hey, I would just tell him that new son of a bitch, Bernstein, downstairs. Remember that time I and you drove into Valone and we got shelled for about 2 goddamn hours and that goddamn cat I shot that jumped up on the hood of the Jeep when we were laying in that hole? Remember? Yes. Don't start that business with that cat again, Clay. God damn it, I don't want to hear about it. No, I mean, all I mean is I wrote Loretta about it. She and the whole psychology class discussed it. In class and all. The goddamn professor and everybody. That's fine. I don't want to hear about it, Clay. No? You know the reason I took a pot shot at it, Loretta says? She says I was temporarily insane. No kidding, from the shelling and all. X threaded his fingers once through his dirty hair and shielded his eyes against the light again. You weren't insane. You were simply doing your duty. You killed that pussycat in as manly a way as anybody could have under the circumstances. Clay looked at him suspiciously. What the hell are you talking about? That cat was a spy. You had to take a pot shot at it. It was a very clever German midget dressed up in a cheap fur coat. So there was absolutely nothing brutal or cruel or dirty or even... God damn it. Clay said, his lips thin. Can't you ever be sincere? X suddenly fell sick, and he swung around in his chair and grabbed the wastebasket just in time. It's a great scene, isn't it?
It'd be incredible to do as a reading, I mean, a play about it, you know.
Yeah.
With two people.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary.
Well, there's great, beautiful redemption in this, and I'll tell you the ending. Corporal Z leaves, and X turns to his mail, and there's a box wrapped and then tied up with string. And he lights the string on fire because he can't untie it, of course. And then he opens this package slowly, and it turns out that it's a broken watch sent to him from Esme, whom he met for 20 minutes in a cafe before all of this insanity, before this method of existence that is ridiculous to say the least. That's how Esme described it. And he opens this watch, and he saw that it was broken, but he put it on, and the story is, and he falls asleep. It's the first time he's been able to sleep in weeks. And in the context of Salinger's, this whole series of short stories, we find that the only thing that can save somebody from total destruction is powerful love. And the story that just, I can do this in a minute, the story just before this one is down at the dinghy. And a little four-year-old boy runs away from home and from his house and runs down and sits in a boat. It's tied up to the dock down at the dinghy because somebody, he's Jewish, and somebody called his dad a big sloppy kike. And his feelings have been terribly hurt, but he doesn't know what a kike means even. But to make this story short, his mother comes down and is able to give in just this beautiful entire presence of herself to him, and the little boy is healed. At the end of the story, she says, let's go find Papa and see if we've got some pickles in the refrigerator, and they run up to the house. And he doesn't want to run away anymore. But my point is, and I think Salinger's too, that some things Mama's love can fix. Mama's love can't fix this. But Esme's love, who's not Mama, who he hardly even knows, makes what I would call an almost agape-like gesture of love that is bigger than her person. It's bigger than something that is relational. It's a loving gesture in the face of this world that where what did he say about it? When he quotes Dostoevsky, I say hell is the inability to love, and he receives this gesture of love at the end. So it's clearly anti-war, right? But there's beautiful redemption in the end that comes for X. Anybody, any thoughts? Salinger ain't as bad as those graduate students said.
Well, he has Franny and Zoe. In the end of that, Franny goes to sleep too.
Yep, sleeps. Yeah, for Salinger, sleep means peace. In Franny and Zoe, there's also a wonderful line about Jesus. Franny and Zoe are arguing about Jesus and whether he's the one to follow, the most important character in the Bible. And Zoe says, "Jesus is the only one who understands the kingdom of God." And then the quote is, the kingdom of God is inside us all. And listen to his language now. Well, we're all too goddamn stupid, sentimental, and unimaginative to look. And that's another kind of radical thinking that, in this case, a fiction writer, but the poet brings to us. We're too stupid. I mean, we can think about all the examples of as a culture and individually. Sentimental, you know, Flanders Fields and those taps. And unimaginative. I can't even imagine letting go of this branch, even if it, you know, would save my life, you know, spiritually, and come to God. I can't let go of the most secure things. We're all too goddamn stupid, sentimental, and unimaginative to look. So poetry can help us undo some of that.
One of the thoughts I have, especially after the falcon image, with how we get so far from center that we can't find it anymore. But on the other side, we've been talking about how we need to change our paradigm because we get so far from center that we no longer can
can identify even what that center is. And so changing paradigm often means going further away from center away in order to see it.
Absolutely. Some of you were here yesterday. For me, what is just emblazoned in my brain is the is this interview with Rosa Parks after she refused to give up her seat to the white man. She says to him, I heard her do this in an interview, I'm not going to give up my seat. I don't see why I should have to. And why do you treat us so mean? And his response is, and he's been very nice to her. I mean, he asked her to leave, but he didn't call her a nigger. He just said, ma'am, you know, why do you treat us so mean? And his response is, I don't know, ma'am, but it's the law. Mm-hmm. He's got a center. And he's the falconer that can hear the falconer, but it's the wrong center. And that's the paradigm shift that I think that poetry takes us there.
It'd be interesting to learn more about young but not so young conservative evangelicals who are going through a change now, who you know have biographically a strong sense of loyalty to Jesus, but are now going through a change as to what that loyalty means.
Yes.
Or even what Jesus is.
Well, Jesus is, but I mean, in terms of centers, that's what I mean. I mean, they had a strong sense of the center, and everything fit together. And now, for some anyway, there's a change in that, and the center is changing.
Going away from Dobson.
Well, that's at one level, but I meant how are they understanding it in terms of, you know, it's the same Jesus, isn't it? Well, you know,
Tim Wallace talks about how they are finding reasons to buy into environmental.
Oh, that's right. And I was just thinking how they would talk about it, rather than how Jim Wallace would talk about it, but how they themselves are thinking, you know, did Jesus change or what's going on?
I just talked to the senior, a great track kid, a straight A student, history major. Fundamental Christian when he came to Augustana. Yeah. And it was a 2-hour talk that ended with, he said, I'm a lot different man with my faith than I was 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's deeper, richer.
Yeah.
Well, part of that, the goodness of that is the organic nature of the faith journey. Mm-hmm. That 4 years from now, it'll be different some more, hopefully.
Yeah. It has
to constantly grow with life.
Yeah. No kidding.
Well, for years, I always viewed Lutheranism as emphasizing the intellectual thing, mm-hmm. Studying and emphasizing the correct theology and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that now there's a certain freedom that's coming through that allows for lots of exploration.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Except our church is getting dumbed down.
Well, the colleges, the Lutheran colleges across the country, I mean, they used to call it Bible, and they went from that to religion, or they call it Christianity. I mean, for all these reasons, you know, they wanted to make it more intellectual. This is not Bible study. This is religion, right? I mean, every college that's Lutheran went through that.
Mm-hmm.
To lift up your idea of what the intellectual part of the faith.
Although
that's good.
I'm starting really low as far as what I understand, and I think Holden has helped me through the years to open up my thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. Well, thank you, everybody, for good ideas. That was fun.
Thank you.